Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Truth and Movies. This week, Toni Collette stars in Hereditary, the nightmarish domestic horror that some are calling the most frightening film in years.
Don't you ever raise your voice at me! I am your mother!
Then, Rupert Everett is Oscar Wilde in The Happy Prince. But is it an ideal biopic? Or a drama of no importance?
Oscar Wilde. Oh, Jesus Christ.
And in Film Club, we celebrate the 25th anniversary of Jane Campion's Oscar and Palme d'Or winning The Piano.
We can't leave the piano!
Yes, it's Michael Leader here, sitting across from Hannah Woodhead, social editor of Little White Lies.
Social producer, it's all semantics.
Joaquin Phoenix correspondent, hereditary hype machine.
Johnny Knoxville, chief critic here.
And Elena Lazic.
Hey.
Welcome back, Elena.
Thank you. I think
you're becoming the Alex Wolf correspondent for the Little White Lies
podcast.
I
was thinking, why am I back so soon? But I know why.
Yeah.
It's because of Alex.
You were here 2-3 weeks ago for my friend Dharma.
2 weeks ago, my friend Dharma. And now Hereditary.
And now Hereditary, which we'll talk about in a second. But first, some correspondence from Phil in London about our Jeff Goldblum chat the other week. My first experience of the Goldblum effect, and still my favourite Jeff Goldblum film, is Mel Smith's The Tall Guy, with a lanky American playing hapless, flawed romantic Dexter King, starring opposite Emma Thompson and Rowan Atkinson, and written by Richard Curtis, who wrote Blackadder. It's one of the wittiest movies of the 80s, with a mixture of intelligent humour, slapstick, and the most quotable lines. I haven't seen this film. I don't think anyone around the table has seen it either.
No, I'm really intrigued, though.
I have seen the trailer because it's the first feature screenplay Richard Curtis wrote, so has that auspicious reputation behind it. But sounds like quite a recommendation. Thank you, Phil. Of course, if you have any other Jeff Goldblum recommendations, we may have to move on from Jeff eventually, but please do send them in to @littlewhitelies, LWLies on Twitter, or truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. So let's crack on with what I believe is the most hyped horror movie of the year, and maybe 4 years, Hereditary. Now, Hereditary, a horror about a family unravelling in the aftermath of a tragedy. Toni Collette plays Annie, and Alex Wolff is her teenage son, Peter. Here's a clip from the film of the two having some polite dinner conversation.
You okay, Mom? Is there something you want to say?
Why would I want to say something so I could watch you sneer at me?
I don't ever sneer at you.
Oh, sweetie, you don't have to. You get your point across.
And say what you want to say then.
Peter.
I tried.
Try again, release yourself.
Stop.
Just say it.
Don't you ever raise your voice at me. I am your mother. All I do is worry, and all I get back is that face on your face. So full of disdain and resentment and always so annoyed. Nobody admits anything they've done.
Sorry, I know it's irrational.
Toni Collette and Alex Wolff there, two powerhouse performances in the horror film of the year. Hannah, you wrote the review for Little White Lies.
I
think it's quite a positive one. That's not spoiling.
Just a little bit, yeah.
Do you want to give us the introduction to Hereditary?
Yeah, so this film, I think it debuted at Sundance right at the beginning of the year, and the reviews coming out were very, very positive. Barry Jenkins said it was the scariest film he'd seen in years, and it had given him sleepless nights. And A24 have, I don't know if they produced it or if they just picked it up for distribution, but anyway, they've kind of spun the hype machine with it and made it into a whole, you can get figurines and t-shirts and things. And it's directed by first-time director Ari Aster, who some will know from his short films. He made a very disturbing one, which I can't remember what it's called, but it's about a father and a son, and they have this very, very like disturbing relationship. So I didn't realise that until after I'd seen Hereditary. And I'd already seen this short film years ago, and I was like, this is all now making much more sense to me, why this director has made this awful, awful in a good way film.
Right.
But yeah, and it's been in the news a lot this week because in America, it has come out with a D-plus cinema score, which is where they poll the audiences after the film and find out how that's enough for context. Some of the worst films ever created have been given like B-plus scores. So for it to get a D is pretty bad. But it's also a kind of indication that the critics may not have the same opinion of the film as audiences.
But then also cinema scores sometimes reveal where audiences may not be expecting this sort of film, or they're maybe surprised in not always a positive way by a film, or moved in ways unexpected by a film. And this is, you know, certainly it's been touted as a horror film that is more... traumatizing than purely scary.
I think that maybe the ad campaigns around this film have called it the scariest film in years. This generation is The Exorcist. Lots of like big talk walking around this film, but I think audiences who are kind of used to like Insidious and even A Quiet Place have gone into this expecting like a jump scare horror, and that is not what it is. It is Insidious, but not in the way that people think it's going to be.
With a small eye.
Yeah, very much so.
Elena, you're quite a horror fan, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're wearing a T-shirt saying The Exorcist today. Not good for radio, but thought I'd point it out. How did you get on with Hereditary?
I've only seen once, which is bad. I think I need to see it again. Mm-hmm. Because when it finished, I literally didn't know what to think at all.
Okay.
I was just... And pretty much everyone in my screening was saying the same. It was all like film critics. And we were like, I don't know what you think of this. I don't know if you think it's very clever or very empty and stupid. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I'm not sure I've really found out what I think of it. But then I think I'm tempted to believe that it's not that great.
Okay.
I know I'm going to get a lot of stuff for that. But I don't know, I was scared throughout, which I guess is what the film aims to do. And because everything is made to be tense. I love horror movies, but I scare very easily. And I basically wash films through my fingers all the time. Like, I just accepted that by myself. And I was tense throughout. But then, ultimately, I don't think that it was about anything. Or I don't think it was really warranted to be so tense. And I think it was just... I mean, it's very good filmmaking, and like he knows how to create tension with the frame and stuff. But I don't think that it's that deep. Or that it's really about anything. And I think it seems to me like this A24 problem with all the films that they're making, which is like they all look amazing, and they have they look like they might be about something amazing, and they look like they might be very intelligent, but you think about it and it's like, oh, I'm not sure what it's about.
I think it's quite hard to talk about this without giving things away or spoiling. Yeah. It's certainly one of those films that plays its cards close to the chest for most of the runtime, but it does feel like it's playing in that similar ballpark to the, let's call them hipster horror films of the last few years, with The Babadook, It Follows, It Comes at Night, most of which were developed or produced or released by A24 in the States. But this is a film that... I mean, for me, I think I might be closer to your take, Elena, rather than the five-star Hannah take. But it's a film that is very impressively, confidently made in terms of creating that atmosphere. There are certain visual and oral audio motifs throughout that are used so well. And performance-wise, you have Alex Wolff, Toni Collette, to a certain extent Gabriel Byrne as well, but just giving real body and depth to this film, whether it coheres at the end into something that means something, and it feels like it's playing in this world where horror does mean something as well as being purely about scares and atmosphere. And it seems to live or die on whether it really works for you in the long run. And I think it worked for you, Hannah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I watched this film for the first time back in March, maybe, beginning of March time, and I went to a very sort of small shishy screening, and just like, I don't know, maybe 20 of us. And we all were kind of just like, what the hell did we just watch? So I've kind of had the benefit of watching as more and more people see this film. And I'm like, I know. And then I saw it again week before last. And I think I really did benefit from a second watch, because you aren't as tense the whole time when you watch it for a second time. You can pick up on more things and see what's going on and make more sense of it in your head, I think. And for me, it is a horror film. No matter what any critic will tell you about this film, it is a horror film. And this talk,
no matter what the director says.
Yeah, he said, God, yeah. Oh, the whole discourse around this film has been exhausting. The whole, like, this is the first horror film to make drama horror. And I was like, no. There was an article today saying it's a really good film because it's turning a family drama into a horror film. I'm like, no, some of the best horror films out there are like exactly. family dramas. Like, don't
look
now.
Horror
like,
films are about families.
Exactly. And but yeah, I think it definitely does benefit from a rewatch. And for me, it's a really interesting sort of look at grief. And mm-hmm. the title of the film is Hereditary, and it is just about like what you pass on to your family and what your family passes on to you. And I think Toni Collette and Alex Wolff's like relationship in the film, their chemistry and the way they interact with each other is like crazy good. In that clip that we heard at the dinner table, it is just one of the most like tense moments in the film, but also hilarious at the same time. It is just sort of the scene from American Beauty where Kevin Spacey and what's her name in
Annette Bening
are arguing across the dinner table, and he's like, pass the peas please. Like, it is just like totally like ridiculous. And somebody, I think it was David and I were having a conversation about Hereditary, and one of his friends said it didn't work for him as horror, but it works as comedy. Which I can totally see. People say that about The Shining as well. Like, it doesn't mm-hmm. if it doesn't work as a horror, it works as a comedy. And I think that's, you know, that's maybe the same with Hereditary. Mm. So if you didn't like it as a horror, maybe think about it as a comedy instead.
But a lot of horror is hilarious.
Well, yeah. It's almost the sort of the physical impulses are so close, aren't they? They're both about tension and release and setups and punchlines and callbacks and recurring motifs. It's all very close, very similar.
I think in Macbeth Views, I've watched way more horror films than I did before, and my reactions have gone from like being terrified and like can't watch the screen to just laughing out loud, like, ha! Every time something really horrible happens on screen, which is disturbing to people around me, but like, it really helps with my viewing experience. But, like, yeah, I think it's a natural progression.
It breaks the tension a bit.
It's the best way to do it.
One thing I want to shout out about the film is the soundtrack, which is one of the things that creates this incredible tension for 2 hours that never lets up. It's Colin Stetson. He hasn't done a film score before, but he's an avant-garde saxophonist who's played with Tom Waits and I think the Arcade Fire and a bunch of other people. And it's just this incredible movie score of a type I hadn't really heard before. He's a saxophonist, so he has a jazz classical background, so it's got this sort of Goretzky, microtonal, avant-garde aspect to it. But there are these experimental, almost electronic edges. It seems like almost sort of drone metal or minimal techno mixed with the scariest of classical music. It's really something. And actually, unlike most horror movie scores, works quite well out of context. I was working to it earlier today.
Yeah, I think when I watched it for the first time, I went away and was kind of like, oh, it's very Gasolini. And it's gone into my rotation now of like weird horror soundtracks that I will listen to when I'm writing, which I'd highly recommend if you like feeling impending dread when you're working.
But this is something that people have noted on. You know, we're in a golden age of new horror soundtracks as well, like Disaster Piece for It Follows. All these new sort of musical talents and visions kind of coming in and changing the expectations. It's really interesting, I think. It is interesting, though, that horror, being this genre that everybody likes to redefine, no one seems confident to call a film a horror film anymore. I wonder, do we know why?
I think there's clearly a basis of that in the fact that it's all based on like physical reactions, and people hate having physical reactions they can't control, which is stupid because emotional reactions, you can't really control them either. Like, there's no difference to me in those aspects. But also, people are just, they think a film is more worthy if it's about topics that are like important in society and stuff, which is so sad because, I mean, that is just not true because art can be just about literally anything.
Yeah, it's interesting how it is the physical reaction. Yeah. So if you think about genres that provoke physical reactions, first and foremost, you have comedy, you have weepies and horror. Mm. And they're all genres that in various ways...
And
well, of course, yeah. And they're all ones that have been stigmatised or rejected in certain ways. And you almost need to get beyond the physical to have... No, it means something as well.
Mm. The idea of a genre film is something that a lot of critics... malign unfairly. Like, I mean, we had it with Get Out, where a lot of people were like, oh, because it's a genre film, then it's somehow not as good. And people, and when something is a genre film, like Hereditary, and I think Get Out is kind of a genre film, people are very quick to be like, oh, but it's better than every other, you know, thing within that genre, which is, I don't think it's helpful. And also, there's nothing wrong with liking horror movies. Horror movies are great. Mm-hmm. And the snobbery around it and thinking like, oh, you like horror movies, that you're not as intellectual as everyone else is very like, it's just silly. It's just, it's totally nonsensical to me. Mm-hmm. And it robs you of this wonderful canon of movies that have a profound influence on other genres as well. You know, when directors are growing up and watching kind of slasher movies and then go and make great drama films, you know, there's a connection. And if you are watching these films and engaging with them, then you have the joy of like watching films and recognizing references. Like the end of an upcoming film, which I will not name, David pointed out to me after we'd seen it, he was like, I'm pretty sure that was a nod to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The film has nothing to do with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing that you can pick up on these like very, very specific little genre references in kind of mainstream arty dramas.
Mm-hmm. And I think one reason why people don't like genre in general is because a lot of genre cinema is based on a template, like the slasher film. It's like, oh, these people go to a house in the woods and then they all get killed one by one. And people think that's dumb in itself. Mm. Like, oh, the director just has to follow this template and make little variations and boof, that's it. That's a film. But like, I think that's what's so good about it. You start from this basis and there's so much you can do, and you can do so many insanely intelligent things. And like, I just watched Evil Dead for the first time, and Evil Dead 2, and I was just like, they're my new favorite films. Like, I just it's amazing what you can do with genre. Mm-hmm. And it's just so sad to think that people are like depriving themselves from that.
Yeah, because personally I think that this tendency to rate Hereditary as being above a horror film or being on a level with the three or four horror films it's okay to like almost it's almost a bad kind of comment to all the other horror films, because I'm quite a big fan of the Conjuring series, and also Mick Flanagan's sort of little sideline of pumping out a great horror film every 6 months, like Hush or Gerald's Game, even, which is a drama with great horrific film. Elements.
Yeah,
I think that there's some great work being made out there that isn't given the platform as something like this. Mm. I hope that they can all coexist, and I hope that when Halloween comes out later this year or The Nun comes out later this year, because of this and A Quiet Place, people will be more switched on to looking at them.
I hope so, and I hope we can get away from this idea that a film like Hereditary has to be more than a horror film. And it can just be a good horror film.
Because horror films have always been more than what people think horror films are. Like, it's so weird.
Yeah,
and it's so funny to me that people like compare Hereditary to The Exorcist as if The Exorcist was like amazing, because it's such a silly film. Like, The Exorcist is so silly, and I love it so much, but it's so funny.
Mm-hmm. I think Hereditary as well. The thing that's amused me is seeing all these kind of very serious reactions to it.
Yeah.
Hereditary is a very silly movie at points, and like there's this great moment where Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne are having this conversation, and she paints miniatures for her career. And after this horrible thing happens in the film, she's making a miniature. He comes in and says, "Jesus Christ, Annie." In his like Irish accent, and she replies to him with, "It's just an accurate representation of what's going on," and it's like the funniest thing to me. And I think I'm a film critic, and I'm probably guilty of this, but the over intellectualization it's not going to happen. the attempt to over explain a film and over estimate a film really is, you know, sometimes it just exhausts me, and it can make you like a film less because you've just had it beaten out of you by the discourse surrounding you.
Yeah, you just like free yourself, like horror films, like whatever films you want to like. You don't have to do that to yourself. You're just wasting so much energy. You could spend watching more horror films.
Exactly. So let's exercise our demons of Hereditary style.
Exactly.
And put... Whoa. Okay, trigger warning. let's throw some numbers at it. Hannah, do you want to go first?
Coming out of Sundance, I'd heard everything. Very excited to see it. So it's a 4 enjoyment, just because it wasn't really like anything I'd seen before. It's 5. And for me, it's a 5. It's held up. I would hesitate to say it's going to be like a 5 in years to come. But certainly, you know, seeing it 3 months ago, it's still very much top of my list at the moment.
Great. Elena?
I would say 4 and 3.5, just because I'm not sure, but I have my doubts.
Yeah, I think the hype really worked a number on me. I avoided as much as possible, but I couldn't avoid it. So my expectations were quite high for that. And I enjoyed it. 4 and then 3, it didn't add up in the end for me, but I will go back and rewatch it. Maybe the second run through is what I need. Thank you for that, Hannah, for that tip.
And I'm just trying to get more box office numbers for it, aren't I? I'm just like,
oh, you're on the payroll, right? Okay, I didn't realise.
We often get accused of this, you know, of critics being in the pockets of studios. If any studios want to put me in their pocket, I would be happy with that. You know, I've got bills to pay.
You heard this here first. And that was Hereditary. Up next, we're going to talk about The Happy Prince, Rupert Everett as writer, director and star in an Oscar Wilde biopic.
Your appreciation has been most intelligent.
Which persuades me that you think almost as highly of the play
as I do myself.
What is the name of this friend of yours?
Oscar.
Oscar Wilde. Oh, Jesus Christ.
I hear you're writing a new play.
Superb.
Abutus.
Constance, my dear, beautiful wife. You and my sons are the things that tie me to life.
Oscar, let's run away. Somewhere no one could find us.
You don't know what you're saying.
Not wearing your silk stockings today, Oscar.
You go too far, sir.
No, you go too far, madam.
I am a ruined man.
So that's Rupert Everett in The Happy Prince. Hannah, you and I saw this in Berlin a few months ago, a little rusty. Elena, you saw this only a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. So how does this pan out? This isn't a straightforward biopic of Oscar Wilde, is it?
No, it's quite daring in many ways, mm-hmm. Visually and structurally. Mm-hmm. It's all presented in sort of flashbacks, but not conventional flashbacks. It kind of jumps around in time a lot. But I was really, really impressed by the audacity and the confidence of and just the passion that's clearly behind this film. I believe Rupert Everett was trying to make this movie for years.
Years, yeah.
And that really comes through, but in a great way, I think. I don't know if I was on board with everything that he tried, but he tried so many things that are so amazing, and so many of them are really successful. So I was kind of blown away by it. I was really not expecting something so daring and original. I thought it was going to be more conventional.
It's not conventional at all, but it really does feel quite deeply felt and considered. And Rupert Everett, of course, one of the great actors of his generation, over the years has appeared in the film version of Importance of Being Earnest, Ideal Husband. He had a one-man play that he's performed over the years as Oscar Wilde. And now this is the product of this. And it's kind of hard with films like this, these biopics where a great star is assuming a great role and they're also making their directorial debut, to view it as almost a passion project or an indulgent thing, an Oscar play, whatever.
Yeah.
But it certainly comes across as he has a thesis, he has something to work out in this movie, this period after Oscar Wilde is released from Reading Jail and actually has an opportunity to start a new life, to start afresh, to maybe even regain his reputation in exile in France. But why didn't he? Is the big question that hangs over the film. Hannah, rousing the thoughts from Berlin back in February, what did you think when you saw it then?
I remember not liking it very much back in Berlin. I like Rupert Everett very much. I think he's a very sincere and funny and open man, which, mm-hmm. I mean, he came out as gay quite a long time ago when it wasn't really okay mm-hmm. as an actor to come out as gay. And he really got maligned by the industry. And this does feel like his kind of cathartic moment of making this film about his hero and writing it and directing it and starring in it. And it is, sort of kind of his big thing that he's been trying to do for how many, 9 years or so. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman at one point was going to star in it. And obviously, after he passed away, I think Rupert Everett kind of, took it upon himself.
Yeah.
For me, I don't know if I needed another Oscar Wilde biopic. I feel like
Stephen Fry's from the 90s.
We had Stephen Fry's from the 90s, which, again, I've not seen it for quite a while. I remember liking it when I watched it. It has something of the kind of Venus, Peter O'Toole ilk about it, showing this kind of great artist in his dying days. Mm. And it is ambitious. I agree with Elena there. There's a lot of things that he's trying to do which are interesting. And I think he's really not afraid to show the sort of fealty of Oscar Wilde at his kind of nadir when he's old and bloated and just a randy old man, basically, who's lusting after all these very young men and being quite lewd, and his poor bloody wife just having to put up with him.
Well, from afar, really, it's Emily Watson. There are a few of these cameos from clearly Rupert Everett's kind of mates coming in for a scene or two, Tom Wilkinson, Colin Firth, Emily Watson. But really, it's the Rupert Everett show, really.
It is,
amazing to think that anyone else could have played this role as the way the film looks and feels and plays out. Under quite a heavy layer or two of makeup there. I think he looked a lot like Mr. Creosote from Monty Python, this Falstaffian large figure. It's not a polite performance at all. It's quite no. There's lots of vomit and spit and sexuality all on display.
I think there's an actual orgy at one point.
There's certainly one bit where he's playing strip musical chairs with Italian
yes.
youth.
Oh, it's so great.
Which is great, but also gets to the heart of what I think is quite almost corner-cutting about this film. That scene is cross-cut with, because it's a Christmas scene, and it's cross-cut with his sad kids abandoned yeah. him back in the UK, singing carols mournfully. And it's like, this is, you know, there's a lot of sentimental shortcuts
yeah.
here
yeah.
That I think undermine what is quite an opportunity to show really the great depth of feeling that goes into this character. Mm.
And I think it's such, he tries really to put so much in one film, and it's very dense in a way. Like, you watch it and you have so much things to work with. Like, there's the visual style in that film is just so intense and amazing and beautiful, and sometimes I would just find myself just watching that and being like, oh my god, how did you do this, why is it shot like this, what did we decide? And then I would, you know, it would be hard to follow what they're talking about. I was just, it was because he really like polished every single aspect of that went into the film. So it's like very, very intense to watch. Like, you get a lot from it, but it also makes it a bit hard to connect sometimes because there's just so much going on. So it's hard to connect emotionally with the character and the story. But I still find myself moved eventually.
Right.
So, yeah.
Were you moved, Hannah?
No, not really. I think all the best lines come from Oscar Wilde's work, mm-hmm. Which he's quite keen to shoehorn in every opportunity.
Yeah,
it was just a bit overwrought for me. And I really appreciate Rupert Everett's passion, and
yeah.
he obviously holds Oscar in very high esteem, but isn't afraid to be kind of realistic about the sort of person Oscar Wilde was.
Mm-hmm.
I was struggling to kind of work out what it was saying about mm-hmm. either Oscar Wilde or about creativity or about homosexuality, because there's
yeah.
a lot, like, it talks about Bosie. Bosie turns up, played pretty badly by Colin.
Oh, yeah.
It's not on there. Colin Murray? That's not right. He's a DJ. Young Colin from Merlin
is how
I will refer to him.
The guy from Merlin,
in this very, very bad wig. And it's very hard for me to actively dislike this film because I like Rupert Everett so much, and it was nice to see him and Colin back on screen together after Centrinians.
Uh-huh.
It just didn't quite... It's very forgettable for me. It's not something that I would think, you know, a couple of years down the line, oh, I really must rewatch that film.
Mm-hmm.
It's like primetime BBC drama, really.
But with a little bit more spittle and bare backsides than you'd expect
maybe
to see.
Maybe ITV drama.
ITV, later on, 9 p.m. Yeah, maybe. shall we round this up? Anything else to say, or should we go for scores?
Yeah, Ellen,
do you want
to
go for scores?
I would say 3, because I didn't know anything about it. I was just like, oh, mm-hmm. this looks interesting. Then enjoyment maybe 4, and in retrospect I would probably still say like 3, 3.5, because I don't think it really succeeded at doing what it was, I think, trying to do, and also I don't know what it was really trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know what it was about. I had a good time watching it. I was marveling at how beautiful it was, but that's it really.
Hannah?
I think it's maybe a 3, 3.2 for me.
Mm-hmm.
I say it's just not, yeah, I would kind of expect more.
Yeah,
caliber.
I'd say 3s across the board, maybe low 3s. This is a film that's quite hard to dislike because it's clearly such a passion project and one that's got a lot of ideas in it. And compared to biopics and biographical dramas we've spoken about on this podcast recently, I think I learned a few things, but maybe not enough. So 3s across the board for The Happy Prince. Up next, we're talking about Film Club, which is this week, is a 25th anniversary look back at Jane Campion's The Piano, starring Holly Hunter and Anna Paquin. And we have a clip after this.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/ACAST. And up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
Oh, no, it can't come now.
It must. She wants it to come.
Yes, and so do I, but there are too few of us here to carry it now. Too heavy. Do you mean you don't want your clothing or your kitchenware to come? Is that what you mean?
We can't leave the piano.
Look, let's not discuss this any further. I'm very pleased that you arrived safely.
Mother wants to know if I could come back directly for it.
Could I apologize for the delay, which I regret was...
After they've taken the other things.
Might I suggest that you prepare yourself for a difficult journey? The bush would take clothing and the mud is very deep in places.
So that is the piano. Holly Hunter is a mute woman sent to New Zealand along with her young daughter, Anna Paquin, and her prized piano for an arranged marriage. Directed by Jane Campion, Palme d'Or winner, multiple Oscar winner as well, best actress, supporting actress and original screenplay. We have a couple of listener comments. Elena, do you want to go first?
Yes. On Twitter, at Tommy James said, whilst there are some great performances, if you're ever in need for a nap, this film is a snooze fest. Gorgeously filmed, though.
Well,
which I can't say I agree.
Thank you, Tommy. Although we did talk about with Zama recently that sometimes snoozing in a film can be quite good. It opens up your imagination. Hannah, do we have a second one?
Yeah, we got one from at Ollie Potts Arts. Love this film. Left a big impression on a 13-year-old me. I don't know if I would have had much of a feeling about this film at 13, but good for Ollie.
Yeah, I think we all watched this for the first time for this film club. This is the great thing about film club. There are certain films that I've kept in my back pocket for rainy days, and the piano being one of them. So looking at this in 2018, this great reputation it has as the only female-directed film to win the Palme d'Or, Oscar winner, great zeitgeist movie of 1992-93. How do we look at it now?
Well, Anna? I mean, it's baffling to me to start with that this is the only film directed by a woman that's ever won the Palme d'Or. Mm-hmm. So that was, I mean, put that to one side. Yeah, the piano is always one of those films that I've never been in the mood to watch. I would never think, you know what I'm going to do today? I'm going to watch the piano. But my mum, actually, you said to her the other night, I'm going to watch the piano for work. And she said, oh, I love that film. Oh, yes. So, it's a very good film. And she's not a film person at all. So it did, obviously, in a certain generation, it kind of inspired this big emotional reaction. And I have to say, I very much enjoyed it. I think it's a really beautifully shot film. Mm-hmm. Some really, really amazing performances from Holly Hunter and Harvey Keitel. And despite her really dodgy Scottish accent, Anna Paquin, her Oscar was very much deserved for this film. And the music in it, I think, was, we were discussing before recording the podcast, the music has become quite entrenched in British culture, I think, because it was featured in a bank advert during the like early noughties, I guess. And so that did slightly sour the film, because all the way through I was just thinking about, you know, like, what was it, Scottish Widows?
Well, it's that the piano theme by Michael Nyman that actually Holly Hunter plays herself on the piano in the film, which is pretty incredible, has become so iconic in itself outside of the film and used in so many different contexts that it is impossible to avoid. But so much of the sort of visual language of the film has become iconic as well. The great opening sequence of just Holly Hunter and Anna Paquin on a beach with the piano almost swallowed by the landscape seems to be something that we see used a lot. I'm getting Scottish Widows being the one that I mentioned earlier. It's one of those films that it's so fascinating to finally watch it. I feel like there are a few in the early 90s that I remember growing up were big movies. Everyone talked about The Crying Game being another one, which I still haven't seen, because there are certain aspects of it that have also been spoilt or ruined or talked about too much out of context. And it's whether we can then watch these films on their own, you know, on their own steam, in a way. Was this something growing up in France, Elena, that was a big movie?
I don't know if it was, because my parents are not all like into film, and they weren't even born in France, so like, we're just kind of living there. And because I'm not from the UK, I don't know about these ads that you're talking about. Okay. So for me, it was just it was amazing actually to experience this soundtrack for the first time, because it's such a weird soundtrack. I mean, it's so like almost like Philip Glass type thing that they play in that setting, and it's just very like strange the first time you hear it. And why would she play that at this time? Like, it doesn't really make sense, but it's so beautiful. It kind of, I think it really adds to the, also like just as gorgeous and intense cinematography and performances. Like, everything is really intense in that film. Like, just in, it's such, everything is like, it's very hard to describe because it's so powerful in every aspect. Like, the every single frame in that film is just awe-inspiring. It's just I can't remember the last time I saw a film like this. It's so nice when it happens, and it's not all the time. And yeah, I was just like, even though it's narrated by a woman, no one could have denied that this film is amazing. So I'm just, yeah, it was incredible to watch it. I watched it on my TV, and I was just like hooked to the screen. It was amazing.
Well, that's something that Jane Campion, as a filmmaker, she is such an atmospheric, sensual, emotional filmmaker. Often her films don't necessarily hang together plot-wise or story-wise, but this is certainly her most popular and successful film, and it's one that you just go with it. Mm. And there are these certain moments that just resonated with me. I love that one of the most sensual and sexy moments in the film is when a character is touching a hole in someone's tights, which is just framed in such a way that you don't, after something like The Happy Prince, which has it all out there, it's something so restrained and small that can really work.
It was also so like shocking. I was like, oh my God, is this a metaphor for what he's doing?
But it's such a symbolically rich film, yes, isn't it? This idea that Holly Hunter's character is married off and sent to the other side of the world with just her piano. She's mute, so it's her only avenue of expression. And the piano becomes this thing that's traded between these two men, Sam Neill and Harvey Keitel, almost in the way that her voice is being, or her sense of self, her agency is being exchanged between these two men.
It's all a metaphor.
Is that something that, do you think it's still given renewed relevance today?
Yeah, I think it, I can totally see why it has held up for as long as it has. And the BFI are actually doing some screenings of it in the upcoming weeks.
I think it's actually a national re-release that Studio Canal are putting together. Yeah,
do not just have to be in London to go and enjoy the piano on the big screen. But yeah, I mean, it's a horrendously sad film, really, when you stop and think about it, despite there being this great romance at the centre of it. There isn't, I don't know how romantic it really is, the relationship between Ada and Baines. Yeah. But yeah, this poor woman who is just traded off like cattle or like the piano and sold to this very sort of serious, brusque and emotionally distant man who longs to be a good husband but has no idea how to do it, and in the end completely botches it. And it, yeah, I mean, it's a total credit to Holly Hunter that she manages to give this absolutely like spellbinding performance just through her face and her body. And the sort of climactic moment in this film when Sam Neill's character punishes her for her affair with Harvey Keitel, the way the camera just lingers on her and like she kind of staggers away from Sam Neill, and it just goes on for so long, and you're like, oh my God, this is just like breaking my heart watching it.
And her reaction in that sequence just tells you everything you need to know about the character. Like, you watch it and you're like, oh my God, I know all those things that I didn't know about her before. Yeah. And this is honestly one of the best performances I've ever seen.
And what's incredible about it for me is that she is such an actress defined so much by her distinctive voice, and so emotionally open in her full body and vocal performances in Broadcast News, recently in The Big Sick, and of course The Incredibles, one of the greatest voice performances in an animated film. And this one, she has nothing. It's so interesting to read in the trivia for this that Jane Campion originally wanted Sigourney Weaver to play the role, and then had Isabelle Huppert come in as well.
That makes sense.
And Huppert said that she was angry with herself for not fighting harder for the role, which is, I really can't imagine anyone but Holly Hunter in this role now. But I
did think of Isabelle Huppert watching it. I was like, oh, this is so much like, actually, this is so much like her performance in The Piano Teacher, which is funny.
So we have The Piano Teacher, The Piano, The Pianist, can keep going down.
Piano themed films.
Yeah, that's a good
The other thing that I noticed about this film, and I'm not that familiar with Jane Campion's work apart from I've seen Bright Star and I've seen Top of the Lake, But the way she shoots New Zealand, which is obviously where she's from, is very different from how I normally see New Zealand shot. I see it sort of shot with the big sunrises and, you know, it looking glorious and sort of think of it as well as Hobbiton from Lord of the Rings. But she shoots it like it is just this sort of grim, miserable Wuthering Heights-esque plane where it's raining all the time and it's just a bit horrible. And poor Arda and Flora have come from Scotland.
Yeah.
And it just looks like they've kind of gone from one bleak landscape to another. And I think that's very interesting, that maybe because she's from New Zealand, she's not as sort of romantic about the landscape and is more kind of like matter of fact about it.
But I think that kind of goes through the entire film and the story. It's like, it's romantic, but it's also not romantic. And it's a subtle like love story, but it's also just not subtle. It's very, very, very obvious in some ways. And I think that kind of makes some people like be like, oh, it's so overdetermined and weird. And like, but I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure that's on purpose, and that's what makes it so amazing and fun. And like, because it's all these people who think they're so civilized, but actually not really. I mean, they just want basic things like most people, and they become really violent very easily. And I think that's kind of the brilliance of it, is that it's so well made, and it's like an Oscar winning film, but it's also like very like simple in a way, and like very brutal, and that's what makes it very fresh even now, I think.
I know I mentioned Zama earlier, but I think this would be play really well alongside that, of these sort of colonial films of gentlemen trying their best in landscapes that don't want them there, or contexts that don't want them there.
It's interesting as well, the Maoris in this film, who are kind of just like a background character, but there's one moment that really got me, like when Flora goes to Baines to tell him to stop seeing her mother, basically, and she's screaming and she's saying, he'll kill her, he'll kill her. And Harvey Keitel's shaking her and saying, what did she say, what did she say? And this Maori woman comes over and goes, she's just a child. And it reminded me of Zama, and the fact that the Maoris in this film and the indigenous people in Zama are kind of like the people that understand what is going on.
They've got their stuff together.
Ludicrous is what's going on in the situation.
Yeah. There's one aspect of this for me, and this might be overstepping a mark, that didn't sit well with me, is as part of this great, sexy, awakening romance between Harvey Keitel's character and Holly Hunter's character. There are these moments where she's playing piano. He owns the piano now, so he says, for every black key, I get to do whatever I want with you. And there's a moment where she's playing piano and minding her own business, and he goes off into another room and comes in starkers. And it made me think of, well, I guess maybe it's Harvey, it's nudity, it's power dynamics. That almost reminds the film for me that is the sexy romance. Now, we look at that now as an exploitation of power dynamics.
But I think it is still in the film an exploitation. I don't think it's supposed to be watched in the film and be like, okay, this is fine.
It's complicated.
And I think it's really like, she's in a situation and she doesn't know what she's doing. I mean, she wants some things, she can't have them, she's trying the best she can, and this is kind of the way it happens, that she has no control. And I think that's what the very, very, very ending of the film, when she says, I think about this, I'm not going to spoil it, but when she says, I think about this some often, lying in bed at night, that's kind of what makes it not that romantic and kind of puts a different light on everything that happened and why she's doing the things she does.
I think it's interesting that originally Jane Campion wanted to end the film. We're not usually concerned about spoiling Film Club for people.
It's 25 years old.
Yeah, I mean, so right at the end of the film, when they're Arda and Flora and Baines are on this boat with the piano, and Arda, through the proxy of her daughter, asks for the piano to be pushed overboard. And then she goes overboard with it. And that is where Jane Campion wanted to end the film originally.
Yeah.
And I haven't actually read why she decided not to end it there. And she kind of adds on this little bit afterwards as an epilogue with the voiceover. But yeah, that totally changes the meaning of the film for me if you think about it ending like right at that moment.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it makes it sadder that you have this kind of epilogue where she's gone on to live this life and you hear this kind of like withering like, you know, yeah, she just seems resigned to her fate or not. But yeah, I think it's
It's a kind of fascinating ending.
Yeah.
Really. and that's The Piano. It's 25th anniversary this year. It's out on national release. Something I would recommend, Hannah and Elena, I don't know if you've seen more Jane Campion movies, or, well, actually, this wouldn't really work for you anyway, but the Tyneside Cinema up in Newcastle are doing a full retrospective of Jane Campion's work, including 35mm screenings of In the Cut, which is my personal favourite of hers, this very sexy, noirish thriller.
With Mark Ruffalo, my bae.
Great
with
moustache.
An amazing moustache. Yeah, I mean, that's something to look up.
And one final bit of Jane Campion trivia, which I love. In The Piano, and certainly in Bright Star, she, at the end of her film, credits the animals that have starred in the film. Mm. Not a lot of directors do that.
Oh.
And knowing Bright Star, her cat is actually the cat that's in the film.
Jane Campion's own cat.
Jane Campion's own cat has a starring role as Fanny Brawn's cat.
That sounds like a bit of feature in the making. Best filmmaker cat. And listeners, if you have any Jane Campion recommendations or thoughts on The Piano, you can let us know at LWLies, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, or on the comments page on lwlies.com/podcast. And that just about wraps up for this week. Next week, Ocean's 8 is the lead film. Next week, should we go through all eight? Can you help me out here? We have Kate Blanchett. We have Sandra Bullock. Aquafina. Mindy Kaling.
How many is that?
That's five.
Sarah Paulson.
Sarah Paulson. I think Anne Hathaway counts in the
Does
eight.
She count? And oh no, who are we missing?
There's one that we're missing. Answers on a Postcard or it's, coming
I feel bad
when
now.
Our brain
I feel
works.
Bad we've,
I saw this film two nights ago and I'm already forgetting it.
Doesn't bode well.
James Corden doesn't count in the eight. Second film next week is Boom for Real, the Basquiat documentary. And for Film Club, we're looking back at Elizabeth, late 90s period drama starring Cate Blanchett in her breakthrough role that bagged her an Oscar nomination.
Your so-called piratas, your pirates attack our merchant ships daily and you think we don't know where the orders come from? The whole world knows these pirates sail up the Thames all the way to your royal bed.
You will leave my presence, sir. Go back to your rat hole.
Tell Philip I fear neither him, nor his priests, nor his armies. Tell him if he wants to shake his little fist at us, we're ready to give him such a bite he'll wish he'd kept his hands in his pockets.
You see a leaf fall, and you think you know which way the wind blows. Well, there is a wind coming, madam, that will sweep away your pride.
I too can command the wind, sir! I have a hurricane in me that will strip Spain bare if you dare to try me!
And also has a great turn from Eric Cantona. I wonder if that's anything to do with the World Cup or if it's just convenience.
I did not know that.
You didn't know that either.
I've learned something today.
Indeed. So let us know what you think about Elizabeth. And it just leaves me to say thank you to Elena.
Thank you.
And thank you, Hannah, as well.
Thank you.
As always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.